Peter Louis Myburgh is the man of the moment, certainly as far as South Africans are concerned, sick and tired of corruption. Well, he didn't just show us corruption, he filmed it. Peter Louis, you're best known as an investigative journalist, as an author. I mean, you've given the Guptas a hard time. You've given a lot of baddies in South Africa a hard time. But my goodness, even for you, filming people passing over wads of cash has got to kind of break a new barrier. And I think South Africa is incredibly grateful to the fact that you went out there. And it's not an easy thing to do. You got to have balls the size of a rugby ball to be able to do this. So well done to you. But let's just start at the beginning. This IDT, and this is what really got me hot under the collar, the Independent Development Trust. It is there to facilitate the government's investment in social projects, build schools, build police stations, community halls, clinics, etc. So it's actually serving the bottom of the pyramid, the poorest of the poor. And it's got a big budget, over $5 billion by my estimation, I'm sure a year. And it is a den of iniquity, as you pointed out. What drew you to investigating what's going on at the IDT?
Yeah, Alex, thanks for having me. Look, I think the very starting point last year, in around mid last year, was when somebody approached me and said, hey, look, there's the issue with the oxygen plants contract that the IDT is rolling out. So, you know, at that point, a couple of years ago, you know, some of your viewers might remember that I worked on that Digital Vibes saga at the Department of Health involving then Minister Zweli Mkhize. And I kind of kept a lot of my Department of Health contacts because of those interactions. And somebody approached me and said, yeah, look, so the Department of Health is currently working with the IDT. We'd appointed them as an implementing agent, which is what the kind of the IDT's mandate is to roll out these projects on behalf of client departments. And in this instance, the DOH appointed the IDT to, you know, roll out this 800 million rand oxygen plants contract. And I had a look at it, and it became very clear that this was just another example of a very dubious looking contract. We reported in October eventually that the main contractor didn't have the necessary regulatory certification, you know, the SAHPRA certificates to work with medical equipment and all manner of other shortcomings in the bid process. And you know, wrote a couple of stories on that. So that's kind of my entry point into the IDT. And as it normally goes, you know, when we publish these kind of stories, more people approach us. And in this instance, somebody said, yeah, so you've been writing about the IDT, but do yourself a favor and maybe have a look at its CEO, especially, and her business dealings and private sort of financial affairs, which drew me to start looking at her properties, her property portfolio. So in April, I think, I published a story on Daily Maverick showing that in a very narrow time frame, she was acquiring cash properties within that period when she was IDP CEO already. Starting in around 2022, 2023, just buying up properties, and there's no bond registered at the deeds office. So we're looking at substantial amounts of cash flowing from the IDT CEO to buy these properties. And then eventually, you know, ultimately I came upon this one property in particular, which is the one at the Waterfall Country Estate, which she bought for 3.6 million rand unbonded and then started building a house. And then you construct your timeline, you know, so the house is going up. And you have an hypothesis, you start to wonder what else is going on. What possibly, if you suspect she's not paying for this herself, what possibly could be the other source of funds? And then I started linking it up and I found out that actually the main individual working on this project, this house project, isn't the person listed on the construction board, because I managed to get into the estate and eventually found out that he's a contractor to the IDT. He's actually contracted to the IDT, this person. So that's where, you know, I started putting all these dots together. And my work then eventually gave me some forensic details showing how this contractor was paying money towards building this house while his entity was getting these multi-million rand employment scheme contracts from the IDT. And at the same time, the actual employees, the workers for this program, they're not getting paid their money, at least not all of it. And now you start to wonder, where is this money actually going to?
It's amazing how stupid these people are, actually, if you think about it. It's you following the money, but in this case, you've got a public servant who's dishing out goodies to a corrupt construction a builder. And my feedback on this, when I phoned around and spoke to a few guys in the construction industry, they said to me, we have been shaken down or attempted to be shaken down by the IDT for years. And it's fantastic that you've exposed this corrupt practice, because now at last, the poorest of the poor might be getting their clinics and their schools and their community centers. And it's that kind of those kind of dots that if journalists connect, as you have done, which has a huge, huge contribution to the national interest.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And as you mentioned there earlier, the IDT has this incredibly important social infrastructure mandate. And if it's not managed adequately, we are going to end up with very costly buildings that do not serve the public. And there's one example of that already. The IDT was tasked to build a high court, a new high court building out in, I'd have to be corrected, but it's either Limpopo or Mpumalanga, one of those two provinces. And that project is absolutely mired in problems and issues to the extent that it cannot be used at the moment. So there's also issues of the contract and the contractors there, which is one of the IDT's kind of bungled public upliftment or public infrastructure projects. And then obviously this whole oxygen plants issue was really, really egregious because, you know, those oxygen plants necessarily are very, very, very much required at those clinics and hospitals at the moment. That need was identified back in the COVID era, the shortage of supply of oxygen at hospitals, and then the IDT just went and bungled that one.
Peter Louis, how do these people get appointed? You've lived with this story. You go back to Digital Vibes, and my goodness, you took on some powerful players there and brought them down to earth. But how does a CEO of the IDT actually get into that position? Are they crooked before they start, or do they get crook when they're there?
Yeah, I suppose one has to speculate over that. I always wonder. So Malaka's background is she worked in quite senior positions within the IDT before she moved up to the CEO position relatively recently. I think only in 2022 or 23 did she actually become IDT CEO. So she's kind of not the long-standing CEO there. So, you know, she's been involved in IDT projects out in Northwest when she had a position there and then in Gauteng later on. And I really cannot answer that. But I do frequently wonder. I wonder if it takes a first kind of bribe offer and, you know, you kind of realize how easy it is to make a lot of money in that way. And it's just a, you know, an absolutely irresistible temptation to do this over and over again. Because certainly, as we've seen with other state capture individuals, state capture cases, they never stop with one. You know, it's a first one, a first dodgy contract, channel to some connected crony. And then when the money comes back to you, I suppose it's just so tempting to keep on doing that and stuff your pockets that it's almost impossible to stop.
In many parts of the world, when they are exposed in the way that you've exposed this person, every single project they've been involved with will then get reassessed and investigated. And in that way, the pus will come to the surface. But I guess the problem here in South Africa is it's so corrupt and there's so much going on that you've got to eat this elephant one bite at a time. But let's go into how they came to offer you a bribe in the first place, because I think there's also a point there that they wouldn't have offered you a bribe if they hadn't been successful at this, presumably with other people. So perhaps we've got other journalists who are running around who are on the take, who are bad actors, who have been facilitating this kind of activity.
Well, Alec, we have to assume that there's very reasonable ground, unfortunately, to believe that, because the Zondo Commission, for instance, did hear allegations, instances, stories about journalists getting paid to do all sorts of dodgy things, cover up stories, to run narratives in favor of certain politicians. That's kind of one of the areas where we have precious little detail. I think partly because, you know, the media has to cover and go and find that out. But I still think, you know, we as a media fraternity have a very important task of ensuring that, you know, our own doorstep is key, and that we do, when we have indications of this happening, examine that. So hopefully at some point there will be more information coming out in that regard. But yeah, the bad actors absolutely have to be booted from this industry so that it doesn't tarnish the reputation of journalism as a whole. So yeah, unfortunately, I think it might be something that does occur. And as you say, I think the brazenness and just the, you know, the very insouciant way in which they offered me that money shows me that they routinely probably do this. Maybe not only to pay journalists, but to achieve all sorts of other goals, you know, to clear regulatory hurdles, to maybe make law enforcement interest go away. There have been Hawks investigations into the IDT, for instance, police investigations. One has to wonder who else is on the payroll.
Just take us through the story of how they approached you. And I read the interview that you did on the Daily Maverick, which said, hang on, that 60,000 wasn't the end game. That was just the start. It was a heck of a lot more money that was coming.
Well, I think, yeah, this is almost the more troubling aspect of this whole scenario is exactly that. Is that, yes, you know, that 60K figure is now the much discussed kind of topic because that's the physical thing that was placed on the table. And I understand that people will naturally react to that. But if everybody pays closer attention, the real issue here is, and a shockingly alarming issue is that they offered me to plug into tenders. They offered me an opportunity to bring contractors to the IDT and then I could get my cut from them. And this is just an insane dynamic, because that would mean then those tenders would have to be corruptly manipulated to ensure that they go to a specific tender company. Because, you know, the IDT, like all government bodies, have these set ways in which they award contracts through procurement, you know, via the procurement regulations and protocols that they have in place. But if what they were offering would have panned out, they would have had to circumvent all of those procurement laws and regulations. And that's really the troubling dynamic here, is that they clearly are not the only bad actors at the IDT, because that would have to mean that the bid adjudication committees and the bid evaluation committees would have been under the CEO's control to ensure that contracts do go to this journalist who she wants to silence.
Extraordinary stuff. And very, very real, and a very practical example. Why was it 60,000 rand and why was it cash? Because it sounds a bit like Bosasa, that they had a slush fund somewhere that they could launder the cash, because you couldn't put that cash into your bank account without raising all kinds of signals at a bank.
Yeah, so I also wonder about the figure. I'm not exactly sure how that came to 60, because so beforehand, when I had that first meeting with the spokesperson, so remember, he approached me in early June, and then we did have one physical meeting, and he always said that that would be in preparation for the actual meeting where his boss, Malaka, would also be present. So during that first meeting at the same venue, he said that I was going to get, he actually spoke about cash, and he said that they're comfortable with flying with about 100,000 rand at a time, but then that the real money would be through tenders, you know, that I can bring contractors for tenders. So I'm not sure how they actually ended up with a 60K on a day. Maybe they ran into some, you know, a limit at the ATM or some problem there. I don't know what happened. But I think the other possibility, though, is that they did not withdraw this money themselves. That, as you say, that there is possibly a pile of cash that she got from contractors to the IDT. That is a possibility.
And where do they get the cash from as well? You follow the money, which is exactly what you've been doing. What did they want you to do in return?
So this is a point of contention now, because obviously the IDT CEO's family trust has now released the statement that came out earlier this week, in which she, yesterday, in which she very strongly denied that know, her intention was to bribe me, and she is effectively throwing the spokesperson under the bus because she says she didn't bring the money, etc. But, you know, in the video we released, you know, I think any reasonable person would come to the conclusion that she's sitting there telling me to make a story go away. And we have those audio clips in the video, you know, it's in broad daylight, in clear sound. We're talking about this house story, and she says, I don't want you writing about it. So, you know, I think the video is very conclusive in that regard. I was working on this story about the waterfall house. She must have picked it up quite early on, because that's when the spokesperson got in touch with me in early June. And then that led to that meeting with her. So that's kind of the sequence, the chronological sequence of events that I've got, you know, that I put together, is that she somehow got wind of it. Spokesperson approached me on her behalf, had the meeting, had the second meeting where she was, and then this cash is presented. And then with all this conversation in the actual second meeting, in Sunday, last Sunday's meeting, I think it's quite clear that she wanted to silence me so that the story about the waterfall property would not be published.
I'm sure there are a lot of people saying, silence you. Well, if they can't silence you with money, they might look at other ways. Do you have those thoughts at night?
Yeah, I do. But I think it's something that all investigative journalists probably, you know, live with. And I'm not the only one that goes into, you know, very, very dodgy terrain, very dangerous terrain. I'm thinking about people like Jeff Wicks, for instance, at News 24, who's been working on Babita Deokaran's assassination and all those distraction networks around the Gauteng health system. And you know, many other journalists in South Africa, Karen Dolly, who works on the, you know, the underworld issues in Cape Town. So, you know, I suppose it's something that one has to consider throughout your work. But it can't be a deterrent, because, you know, if somebody doesn't do this work, then there's a void. And in a void like that, the South Africa, a country, becomes a captured criminal state. So it is one of the safeguards against that. And I'm sure hopefully all South Africans would agree that we can't slip in that direction. So yeah, the danger is there, and we don't take it lightly. If there are real indications of specific actors having those intentions, we do step in and organize the people, arrange the necessary security protocols, etc. And we keep our, you know, our ear to the ground. But the work has to continue.
It's an interesting contrast, because a lot of the work that I've done early in my career with people like Barry Sargeant, Julius Cobbett, with our investigations team, it was always at the top level, high level. Kebble went in, but then they don't, as soon as our view was always publish quickly, and then it's out in the public domain. So they really, you're not really a target. But of course, they went and shot the managing director of Alan Gray as a result. Stephen Moldenhall, because of what we'd published, and that was Brett Kebble and so on. But in this case, what would really worry me, sitting in your shoes, and it's a different area, is that nowadays it costs 2,500 rand to get some assassin to go along and pop off anybody they want to. That's how bad or how cheap life has become in South Africa. So the work that you guys do, especially because you're dealing with, well, people not as sophisticated as these multi-billion rand scams, that there could be that kind of a knock-on effect. So I really do hope that you look after yourself and continue to do the incredible work that you do in a very, very mucky pool. But it hasn't stopped you. It certainly hasn't prevented you from exposing.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. Yeah, I'm trying to do the sum now. How many assassins can you appoint at, you know, 500,000 rand?
I thought of the same thing. You know, I thought, jeepers, if these people were in that league, then, or in that kind of person. So, fortunately, I suppose they're a bit scared of also the consequences. I guess those 2,500 rand assassins are mainly taxi bosses and people like that. But getting back to the overall kind of thrust of this, this Republic of No Consequences, which might even have been a title of one of your books, where do we go to from here? If you'd been brought into this crazy national dialogue, had it actually or were it to happen, what would you tell them? Because given the exposure you have, and I'm not trying to say that you're the oracle, but certainly you've had far greater experience than a bunch of guys living in ivory towers. How would you say we start to address the issues that South Africa desperately must?
Yeah, look, I think there are a few hard but relatively easy fixes in a sense. You know, I think it sounds contradictory, but I would skip the talk shops, honestly. And I think that is a general sentiment out there at the moment, is we don't need a 700 million dialogue, 700 million rand dialogue to fix what a lot of us view as evidently obvious in terms of fixing some of South Africa's most pressing problems. So the first would be, and this very clearly came out at the Zondo Commission, is to fix the space in which criminal offenses is investigated and prosecuted. So the entire criminal investigations judicial framework needs a radical redress. The NPA, and especially the NPA's unit tasked with going after high-level corruption, is in radical need of more funding and resources. So they are short-staffed. The Hawks's criminal/corruption busting units are also hollowed out because of those, you know, state capture Zuma years. And these are two entities that really, if they start doing proper, you know, arrests and then successful prosecutions, and it happens routinely and it's not kind of an isolated thing, which is currently happening, then the deterring factor becomes all the more overwhelming. And should certainly put a chilling factor on the brazenness with which the corruption is currently happening. And that is something that does not require a national dialogue. I think it really is one of the key problems facing South Africa still after the Zondo Commission. And I think that's what's really been alarming to a lot of us, is the Zondo Commission was supposed to be this cathartic moment where we aired all the corruption and we're going to deal with it now quickly. And then now we're sitting 4 years after the conclusion and, you know, the recommendations. And not only are the existing or the previous state capture cases not really being prosecuted in large numbers, but many new corruption fiascos or scandals have emerged after that. So I'm always like, almost like in my timeline nowadays, cutting it up as state capture one and state capture two. If you look at the recent history of South Africa, we had the state capture version under Zuma, with the Guptas and many other players. We shouldn't make the mistake of only saying it's just the Guptas. But then in steps President Ramaphosa in his supposed reform era. And then we still have things like Digital Vibes and Babita Deokaran and so many other issues that I can't name now. So we clearly haven't sufficiently addressed that malaise. And I think that's one of the key things. Cleaning up the state sector and its procurement environment, definitely. Appointing appropriate people who work in those procurement spaces, ensuring that the lifestyle audits are routinely conducted. You know, these are things that can be done. And it's very manageable for an entity like the IDT to have an ongoing lifestyle audit process in place to ensure that its officials aren't on the take and bending the tenders in the direction of where they're connected cronies. So, yeah, definitely. In short, if I had somebody's ear on that level, let's pause this national dialogue. Let's not go ahead with it, and let's just implement some of the fixes that there seems to be such wide consensus on in terms of what we need now in South Africa to clean up the procurement spaces, so that the corruption at that level can be stemmed.
And perhaps also just keep joining the dots as you've been doing, so that the public can realize that it's actually the reason you don't have a clinic is because there's some scoundrel up the chain who's been stealing from you. Just finally on all of this, and particularly the IDT, because this is the subject under discussion here. My feedback from the construction industry, as mentioned earlier, is that there are other players. The IDT's chief executive is clearly, she's awful and corrupt, and she's a cog in the chain. But I remember listening to a terribly boring speech by Thabo Mbeki once. I don't know if he's ever had a stimulating speech, but a terribly boring one where he said, it's not just the corruptors, it's the corruptees, it's the corruptors as well. And that further up the chain is where the real money is made. We saw that with the Guptas. They were making the big bucks, whereas those who they bought were kind of bought off for chump change. Are you making any progress on finding those or exposing those people, the Mr. Biggs and the Mrs. Biggs, further up the ladder?
Look, I think the highest step of the ladder in the political terms, obviously, are your executives, like the executive level. So those are the people you want to expose to clean up leadership in places like the IDT. So I think this is starting to happen at least within the IDT. You know, Teboho Malaka, it's very unlikely that she'll make a comeback after this. But, you know, in terms of our executive level, I think, well, what is clear is that even on the cabinet executive level, we are being run by individuals who are involved in top-level corruption. And, you know, if you look at the recent reporting on Minister Simelane, for instance, and that BBS saga, who's still sitting in the cabinet. And there are questions over some of the other cabinet members coming from the Zondo Commission days. And, I mean, even Judge Raymond Zondo the other day publicly lambasted the executive or President Ramaphosa's office for having these people in his executive, in his cabinet, despite the fact that they had these state capture clause over there. So, you know, I think it's definitely, it goes to that. That is the top level. On the private sector procurement side, I think that the top level, they are the people who captured these entities. They are the, you know, the people who routinely, you know, get away with these dodgy contracts. Nothing happens to them because we have to assume that the entire space is captured. Possibly law enforcement officers and those kind of people too. So I think that is the dynamic we're dealing with now, is that capture, state capture has just continued unabated. The Guptas left, but new actors emerge in their place. And they are continuing with business as usual and still capturing these entities and you know, diverting billions to their entities and their connected people.
Peter Louis Myburgh is an investigative journalist with the Daily Maverick and a best-selling author here in South Africa. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.